And we also meet a gloriously sunny-faced chap this morning, who I think's brought the weather with him, quite honestly. I think the last couple of years has proved, you know, that in our area, absolutely is bursting at the seams with creativity in writing, in art and in music. And we're proving it again this morning, so please welcome children's writer from Redcar, Chris Hart. Morning to you, Chris.
Good morning.
You are sunny.
Thank you.
You are sunny. You brought that with you. Absolutely. Now, that you got in touch the other week and mentioned about your writing. Now, lots of people think children's writing, oh, that must be dead easy. Is it dead easy?
No, it's the story. The story could be the same for an adult or a child. It's just how you coach it, how you develop your characters, who you put the mouth of the story to translate through. I mean, who do you want to listen to? Do you want to listen to an 11-year-old girl telling a story? Or do you want to talk to somebody who's a grizzled old angry 55-year-old man?
You're not describing yourself there, are you?
Would I?
Now, Chris, this is not your full-time job, is it? I mean, you work with computers otherwise, don't you?
That's right. I'm self-employed, but I do 3 days a week teaching. I'm teaching out in Whitby, and I'm teaching computer science out there.
And so where does the storytelling come in? Have you always had a writing interest?
It was my best subject at school, and when I left school, one of my teachers came up to me and said she looked forward to reading my first novel. So all these years later, I hope she's still around and I hope she gets to read it. I absolutely loved English, English language, expression, stories, and I've always written little short stories. It's like little episodes just appear, and I think, I've got to write that down.
So who, I mean, when you were writing, were you writing short stories then?
Yes, yes indeed. I mean,
who influenced you?
Oh, my influences are from the science fiction genre. Isaac Asimov was the biggest. I devoured his books. My older sister had a job while I was still at school, and she used to buy those books, and I used to read them whenever I got a chance, and I was absolutely transported by his ideas of what the future would be like, hopping from planet to planet, shooting the bad guys and settling new colonies all over the universe, and that really stimulated my imagination. But then it became a little bit more mundane. At 16, I joined the forces, but I had to wait a couple of months before I got in, and so my dad wouldn't see me sat on the settee for that time, and got me working in the Chris factory in Billingham. And I was painting a 96 degree room, which meant that I was spending an awful lot of time in a sweat induced haze thinking of weird and wonderful things. And it's amazing what you think about in those conditions.
Hey, it's funny that that chap you've just mentioned, what was the name again?
Isaac Asimov.
I'll tell you why, there was a programme the other night on BBC 4, and it was about robots. It was Daniel Sanford, and he was talking about him as a writer. Mm-hmm. And was it the three principles of the robot?
Yeah, robotics, that's
what
right.
What were the three principles?
Oh, I asked you not to ask me any hard ones. But the first one, of course, is that no robot can cause harm to a human. And then you have, in no particular order, no robot should allow itself to be harmed unless it meant contravening that previous law. And then finally,
the third one is about not breaking the other two, I think.
I don't know off the top of my head. Yes, it was well done, well thought out. And, of course, the later books see the flaw in the logic of that. Because when you talk about people, are you talking about individuals or are you talking about planets of people? And that, funnily enough, just creep into my book towards the end.
Interesting. Now then, you said there about being a 16, you go into the army.
Mm-hmm.
So, I beg your pardon, the Navy. I knew it was forces. Was your writing, did that continue with you while you were there?
It did, because there's not a great deal you can do when you're on watch at 10 o'clock at night till 2 o'clock in the morning, when everybody else is tucked in and it's pitch black on a ship and you're on an exercise. There's no lights anywhere except maybe an internal light in a cupboard somewhere. So you'd do your rounds, you'd sit down for 10 minutes, then you'd do some more, and in that time there was a lot of very, what can I say, impressive stimulus. Walking around a ship, the creaks, the chains, the aircraft moving about in the back. And So that time generated a lot of ideas, a lot of sounds, a lot of input.
If it was all dark, how did you get any writing done then?
Well, I had a little light in the cupboard and I used to sit in the cupboard.
Right, so you then left the Navy.
Yeah.
You've moved into academia with the computers. So where did the writing take you then?
The writing sort of died off a little bit because when I came out of the Navy, I used the money that I got as resettlement to put myself through a degree. And I did software engineering, which was brand new. I think we were the second class ever to do it in the country. I was working with computers before they were called computers. We had radar systems, sonar systems, but you couldn't pop into your local Tandy's and buy a machine in them days. So I'm a little bit older than perhaps I should be. And the writing really took a back seat because I focused on the university stuff. But I was looking at some of my old books from my university, and in the back there's daft little episodes again. I'd pick on a character and I'd make something happen and it would just be outrageous and it would just be wrong. And... so it was an area when I thought I had a dearth of writing, but really looking back, I probably did have lots of little bits going on as well.
Right, so there's then that point, and lots of people say, oh, there's a book in everybody, and I don't think I've ever found that book in me particularly, but I know lots of people who say that. So was that something that you always felt, I'm going to get this down and write a book one of these days?
I always wanted to write a book, because when your favourite teacher at school tells you you're good at this, you should do this, that never really leaves you. That you always second guess and say, well, maybe I should try that, maybe I should go for that. I never considered that my little stories that were 2 or 3 pages long would ever amount to anything except something that was going to be screwed up and put in a waste paper basket in a few weeks time when I came across it again on a pile of paper. But I didn't. I kept some of them, and in my mind they grow and they grow and they grow, and as you go through and you work at your job and you realise the importance of planning, and you start thinking, well, if I plan this book, if I plan that my character's going to start like this, become like this, how will that character end up? Because of course everybody says they have a book inside them, but authors finish books and not everybody finishes the book they start to write.
Oh, exactly. Well, we're going to take a break, have some music. When we come back, we'll find out about these books specifically. With me this morning is Chris Hart, who is a children's book writer. Now, I've got two of your books in front of you. Have you written two, or is this two of several you've written?
This is the first two that have gone through all the way to publication. The third book is due out. It's currently undergoing final proofing. Obviously, I don't do that because nobody ever sees their own mistakes, do they?
Absolutely.
So I pass that on for that process. And when it comes back, I'll give it the once over. And if everything's okay, then we'll go through and we'll send it off to Ingram Spark and they'll do their little checks. And if it's all okay, then it'll get published.
And this is all self-published, isn't it, for you?
Yeah, the whole process from the ideas right through the writing, everything. In the first book, I had it professionally edited. Very nice gentleman called John Appleton, I believe his name was. He's an ex-editor of the Enid Blyton Foundation.
Oh, wow.
And I sent it off to a group to be edited, and he was assigned to edit it. I didn't get a chance to actually pick him as such, but it was perfect, because I've always said it's a mix of Isaac Asimov meets Enid Blyton, if you can imagine that.
An interesting combination.
Yeah.
Now, the series that you've got is Molly and Corrie, the Molly and Corrie series. Tell us about that. Where do they come from?
Well, Molly was just one of those names. As you know, I'm a teacher. I've taught from age 6 upwards. I used to go in and teach Lego robots to people. And there was always, I don't know, a really keen, a really interested student. And often they were called something like Molly. It was just weird. And whether it's a name association or not, I'm not sure. But I don't actually know anybody called Molly. Been racking me brains. I've never met a Molly in my life. So it's a strange one. But Corrie, the name is actually it's a friendly contraction of Corvus, which are initials, which is suiting the artificial intelligence system, which is a military system designed to look after the people, to defend the people. And Corvus, the system, decides it can't do its job properly unless it understands who people are. And in its travels trying to find out information, it meets Molly. Somebody who wants a friend, somebody who wants to be a part of Corrie's life, and Corrie wants to be a part of her life, and they strike up a very strange but very interesting friendship. And the first book is subtitled The Friendship Paradox, because Molly seems to come to the conclusion that to get a friend, you have to be a friend. You have to treat someone friendly before you can actually gain friends, which is important to her. She's new in the neighbourhood. She doesn't know anybody. Her mother says she should have friends. She's quite happy tweeting on a mobile phone, playing on a tablet, messing about on the computer. She doesn't understand why social interaction is important. Her mother's pulling out her hair, saying, get out there, make friends. And she just thinks it'll happen. She's had friends in primary school. She can't remember how she made them, so she's of the opinion they'll just occur. They'll just be there when she needs them. And
That's a really interesting story, actually, because there must be lots of parents who feel that their kids are always connected on, you know, it's everything Snapchatting and that sort of thing. And everything's virtual and online as opposed to in sort of human interaction and person to person.
Yeah, I have children of my own, and they're very much the digital age. They live with their thumbs, and they're always talking to strangers up till 9, 10 o'clock at night sometimes when I don't take the machines off them.
Talk to strangers?
I call them all strangers because they may be friends, they may be a friend of somebody else, but they've never met them, they've never sat in a room and had a cup of tea or a glass of milk or a chat. Yes, they might like the same music as you, but how many times have you said to someone, oh yeah, I like that, and then you've sat in a pub and it's come on and you've thought, oh God, this is dire, you know?
Is this kind of making it kind of accessible to parents, if you like, this book? So who are you aiming this at?
Well, it was originally intended to be aimed towards newly confident readers between the ages of 7 and 8, up to about 12. It contains a little bit of information about the key points of the computer systems, GCSE stuff, and I thought, when the kids now have to learn that subject, instead of going in cold, maybe they can read a little bit about it and at least be able to relate it to a story somewhere along the line. But my main test readers were all adults, and they all came back and said, this is so funny, this is hilarious, this is great, I really want to read this book, have you got the next one ready? And I was thinking that this wasn't my audience, this wasn't my intention. So now I just say 8 and up, because
that's a fair sweep of age. Now, you do work, it's not full time, but you do work. So how regimented are you when it comes to writing stuff?
9/10 of my writing is thought work. I know that sounds lazy, but I take my laptop everywhere I go. I've got notepad on my mobile phone, I've got notepad on my tablet, and I bring out ideas in everything I see. So my writing is constantly with me. The sitting down at the machine and typing, well, I tend to be a bit obsessive. When I start, I don't stop. And I mean, I can go for days, literally 2-3 days, and never come out of my room, except maybe to eat. And I might get 4 hours sleep and I'll be back there again doing it again. So it's the way I work. There's lots of people who work, or we do 2,000 words on a morning and that's great for the day. That's fantastic. Some days I might only write 30 words because I've reread what I've done before. I don't like it. I'll change something. And the number tally doesn't change. But other days I'll come out and say, I've just written 25,000 words. What happened there? You know, and it just flows from me. And it's hit and miss. But I have a schedule, I have a timetable, I know when things are going to happen. I started the latest book in March, I knew that by June it would be ready. And then it's a case of people are now giving me advice and saying, oh, these are good books, you have to think about marketing. You don't want to release this now. October's the best time to release a child's book for the Christmas market. And I'm saying, well, might be if I was J.K. Rowling and I was pushing for the last penny, but I want to get on with the next book. I want to start, and I can't do that until I've got this one underlined, published, and available.
All right, okay. Now, you mentioned there about the fact that it is sort of people of all ages are enjoying it. Now, people are going to be able to enjoy you doing some reading at the weekend, aren't you? Just discovered this piece of news.
Yes, we've just had a visit from Tiny Pixie that's dropped in a an advert for the Primrose Bell Market in Redcar, which is on this weekend. And apparently I have a stall to sell some of my books and some of the associated drawings with the books as well. So that should be fun. And we do have a few little bits and pieces that go with the books, some nice pictures and some bookmarks and things. Although usually I give those away to the kids, so that's not a problem.
Because it's a bit of a family affair as well, isn't it? With is it your son?
My nephew.
Your nephew does some of the artist work.
Yeah, my nephew is Scott Leyland. He's come out of university as a graphic artist. He's worked on a few projects. Recently finished an animation with Mike McCartney, Paul McCartney's brother, name
Ooh,
dropping there.
No way!
And he's currently working part-time for a design institute over in the West Coast. And they basically take anybody's ideas and they will generate either an initial design, like an architectural design, or they will look at something like a new vacuum cleaner. And they don't just do the technical designs, but they're the ones responsible for the really wow posters type thing when you get a new thing come out for the first time. Uh-huh. So he's loving that as well.
Interesting. So the fact that you can bring him on board and say, would you mind designing my front covers? That's absolutely fabulous.
Oh, no. He designed my characters because I can't draw people for love nor money. And I've never been able to do that. But he didn't know the stories because when I asked him to do it, I didn't know the story. I didn't know all the stories. They grow as they move and things happen. Halfway through book two, I thought I had it all neatly nailed down, and I suddenly realised there was no physical evidence to tie the culprit to the crime. And then suddenly I had to take a whole new look at what I'd done. But instead of rewriting the book to slot in a few bits of physical evidence, I thought, okay, what would you do now? If you're an 11-year-old person and you had the world's greatest computer assistant, how would you go about getting that evidence? And so then the book takes off again. And it was like the story was all about to wrap up and now it's opened up again. And, it was really strange for me as an experience to live the book as I was going through it. And everybody has said, those who've done the test reading, that the way it works, the second book actually works much better as an interesting dramatic storyline for a kid's book.
Now we're going to be able to get a chance to meet you at the weekend, aren't we? This Saturday, I think?
I believe so, yeah.
Is that right? And where are you going to be?
Apparently I'm going to be in the Bohemian Cafe in Redcar, and I will be doing a reading from the book. So if anybody fancies coming down and listens to me, grab a cup of tea, and we'll have a bit of a laugh and we'll go through some of the choicest excerpts.
Oh, fabulous. Chris, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, but when you get your next book ready to go, come in and talk to us about that.
Thank you very much.
Chris Hart, thank you very much.
Mid-mornings on Zetland Air.